Basically, I am dealing with pre-imperial China, so 3rd century BC and earlier. The manuscript that I will be focusing on is 4th century BC, and this is during the so-called Warring States period. And one of the aspects of this period that you have to keep in mind is, of course, all texts have their political contexts. And this time period is a time of extreme chaos, but also extreme intellectual creativity. So thinkers were coming up with all different kinds of strategies to deal with the political chaos. And some of them came up with brutal systems of punishments. Others came up with systems for awards based on moral behavior. Others just totally withdrew and became passive and tried to get in tune with the cosmos. And some promoted historical memories, and others completely denied it. During the 4th century BCE, which is the time period of the manuscript, which we'll eventually talk about after a certain number of lead-ins, we have to keep in mind that there are a number of dao, ways, methods that people were looking at. And so in this lecture, I will focus on a kind of Tao that involves self-cultivation. Now, we usually think of self-cultivation in terms of Taoism, as you know, getting in touch with the cosmos and having nothing to do with the outside world. But this Tao of self-cultivation borrowed a lot from Taoism, but in fact, it's a Confucian version of this, which has a moral tale, a moral strategy. And indeed, it's an educational method for training young elite heirs, young men, in both moral responsibility in society, but also using mystical techniques to transform themselves into sage-like rulers and mythic human beings. So it taps into a sort of eternal time, which fits in some of our conversations in our seminars. So the text I'm going to deal with is called Zhou Gong Zhi Qin Wu. It's the lute dance, the lap lute. The lutes are also called zithers, but I'm going to call it lute. Zither is a common name for it, but some people prefer to call them lap lutes or lutes, so that's what I'm going to stick to. And it's a lute dance by the Patriarch of Zhou. Now, I'm not calling him a duke. I reject all feudal titles, so you'll just have to put up with that. And I will also call him Zhou Gong. So this text is probably copied from an earlier text. So C14 dates dated approximately around 300 BC, but because it's probably copied, we can assume safely that it's a 4th century BCE text. It is, now, even though it has to do with the Patriarch of Zhou, it is really not Zhou, and we'll talk a little bit about this, what makes it Zhou, what makes it not Zhou. It does have a lot of intertextuality with the Book of Odes and the Book of Documents, which are classic texts that a lot of scholars think have Zhou chapters. Obviously, from the way I say that, I think it's doubtful, but then I'm an outlier in this. We will be talking about my three topics, the number nine, musical performance and personal transformation, in terms of this text. But first, I have to give you a little bit of context for these various factors. Okay, so a little bit about this text and, in fact, the discovery of bamboo texts generally. In the past few decades, the world of classical studies in China has been rocked. They have been finding close to hundreds, but lots and lots of different kinds of new texts. They are stored in tombs. These tombs are waterlogged, so they're anaerobic. That means that they have no oxygen due to the water and the mud, which preserves the text, preserves the ink, amazingly enough. Yes, there are a few forgeries, but they're pretty easily to detect. This text is not a forgery. If you've heard otherwise, forget it. There are a number of different kinds of texts. The place that I show you here is outlines a city called in a region called Jiangling. Jiangling is sort of the metropolitan area of the Chu state. From my book, Defining Chu. It is a southern state. It was originally considered barbarian, but actually the archaeological things that we have found associated with the Chu state has informed us that it is actually a very refined civilization. And in fact, a number of tombs have revealed a sophisticated number, range of texts, everything from Taoist philosophy to Confucian-style texts, to tomb inventory texts, to divination texts, such as the one that Zhao Lu and I are translating, and a variety, Zhou Yi texts, manuals, philosophical texts, everything. It's truly amazing. The text that I'm going to talk about is a collection called the Tsinghua Collection. Now, what does it mean to have a Tsinghua Collection? It means that these texts were taken from a tomb, stolen, they were plundered, and went to the Hong Kong Antiquities Market, like a number of these groups of texts, for example, the Shanghai Museum texts. And after some negotiation with antiquities dealers and people going in and to verify that they're not fakes, these organizations, such as the Shanghai Museum or the Tsinghua University, take them on and start protecting them and then slowly publish them. Now, the Tsinghua team has to be congratulated because they've been publishing them really fast. They got them in 2008, and they've been already have five volumes out, and they're amazing texts. They really are truly amazing. They also give us a lot of different versions of chapters of texts that we knew about through the transmitted tradition, but they're kind of different. And so it really provides a lot of discussion there. This text is in volume 3 of the Tsinghua volumes. It's because of its rhyming features and because of the overall format of it, I'm going to contextualize it as an educational text. I actually think a lot of the texts that were found in tombs were probably educational texts. And that's a different paper, maybe. So this one, some of the general features are that it's 17 strips, and each strip is about 45 centimeters long. Bamboo strips were originally intertwined together with strings. Okay, a couple features of this text. The historical framework of it is the legends of Zhou Gong, the legends of Zhou Gong can be fit into a larger framework of the legends about the Zhou state, promoted by mostly Confucian scholars. And these legends are often transmitted through time in terms of dances and songs. And many of these dances or songs are associated with historical legends and mythic figures within the Zhou context, but also sometimes prehistorical context as well. Now, young boys, according to later ritual texts or contemporary ritual texts, had to learn many of these dances and songs in order to be capped and in order to be considered an adult. Now, the idea of becoming an adult is an important aspect of our text. Even later texts acknowledge this aspect of the songs and the historical legends. For example, the Du Duan, which is a 2nd century CE text, also takes various odes that are famous for being Zhou and links them to historical events in the establishment of the Zhou state. So the Zhou state becomes sort of an idealized state. It becomes a model, which will become important later on, as we shall see. Now, one of the things that's an important aspect of this is that this text is a 4th century BC text, and yet it takes events from the 11th century BC and uses those to create the learning environment that we will be analyzing. Okay, so one of the important aspects of Zhou Gong is that he created a new city. He was involved in creating a new city. Not only did he take over the government for the heir, who was underage, but he helped the heir create a new city, and this city is called Chengzhou, which actually, if you translate it, means the created Zhou or the completed Zhou. And we'll be looking at this word Cheng quite a bit. In fact, the king's name was King Cheng too. Coincidences, but fun. Now, the other thing that he did that is really part of the legend that is extremely important to the 4th century BC idea is that he was a model of the loyal minister. He was extremely competent, much more competent than the king himself, but he never tried to assert power. He always stayed in his place because he did not have the proper heritage or the proper blood to inherit the throne. So in terms of hereditary law, he could not be king. And this is an important factor in the Warring States argumentation as to who could be king, who deserved to be king, and who did not deserve to be king. And this became this King Zhou's warnings to the young King Cheng became sort of parables of educational formats. And we will see that the text that we're going to analyze is exactly in this format. Also, we have to understand that songs and dances were teaching devices. So they were also teaching devices for teaching parables and for preparing young men for government service in the ideal state. Okay. So the lute dance itself, and that's what I'm going to just call it from now on, is just the lute dance instead of the lute dance of Zhou Gong, blah, blah, blah. Okay, so the lute dance uses a narrative device of warnings, as I just said. And these warnings are to a group of young men that represent Zhou Gong's original settlement of the Shang refugees. The Zhou state, one of the major events of the Zhou state was conquest over the Shang people who had done immoral acts. And so the Zhou early founder kings, full of morality, went, they conquested, they got rid of them, and they took all the noble officials left over, and they moved them to Chengzhou, the new city. And so Zhou Gong, that was one of Zhou Gong's acts, is to warn these officials. But he did so using the voice of King Cheng. So this is a chapter that's in the Book of Documents, by the way. So, but the song that we're going to look at is actually a slightly different version, and the who's talking and for whom will become an issue, not one that we can resolve, by the way. The 4th century bamboo version has a 9-part song, and it claims to have a 9-part song by Zhou Gong and a 9-part song by King Cheng. But unfortunately, Zhou Gong's, as we will see, is cut off. So scholars debate, does that mean that when they were copying this and throwing it in the tomb, they just didn't bother to add Zhou Gong's, they only added King Cheng's 9 versions? Or should it really have been the 9-part song of King Cheng? Now, on the back of the text, it actually has written that it's the 9-part song of Zhou Gong. So it's a little bit dubious. Wait a minute here. The vocabulary associated with this 9-part song is very interesting and also a subject of debate, besides also the voice of who is talking when. And there's 9 sections of this song, and there are different ways to interpret this archaic word. This word right here, which is right here, which is right here. And people argue as to exactly what modern equivalent it might have been, but in fact, nobody argues, except one scholar who's completely wrong, that it is anything but talking about a movement of the songs or a musical performance. Even the scholar who is wrong tries to claim that it's part of a musical performance, but it doesn't phonetically work at all. Now, I'm going to go with this word right here, which has the double sense. It has two senses. The oldest sense is an arrangement of chimes, chime bells or chime stones along a rack. Usually they're graduated and have different pitches. So that's the oldest meaning of this word. And then the second meaning, which is also active by 4th century BC, is musical pitch. So it's one of 12 pitches. So it is significant that a number of ancient Chinese words were actually polyphonic. So maybe this word was polyphonic and it had two readings. I don't know. We can't really resolve that. But I'm going to stick with Lu, this word. Oops, shoot. I'm going to stick with this one for the moment. But in fact, it's significant that it could also mean Cheng. And Cheng was the word for one musical movement, one completion. Okay, so these movements, especially King Cheng's part, King Zhou Gong's part only had the opening section. It didn't have the closing section. But King Cheng's nine movements have openers and closing movements in each of the nine sections. And so the question is, scholars have also debated, what do these mean? But generally, they assume that it has something to do, and they draw this from other transmitted texts that describe musical performances. It seems to be music, the opening is accompanied with people coming in and taking their places, in a sense. The music, the lines of dancers are coming in, the musicians with their lutes and their mouth organs are coming in. And so the opening seems to be a coming in, and then the closing seems to be a going out. Now, what they actually do in between, we don't know. So we have nine sections of openings and closings. We really just have to sort of imagine what kind of music was happening in between. We do know that the literary piece that we're going to be looking at was sung. It is full of internal rhythm. It has end rhymes, it has internal rhymes, all sorts of rhyming and rhythm. It was certainly sung, and in fact, early attempts of mine to connect it to certain instruments were mildly successful, not totally. Has to be worked on a little bit. What we don't know is exactly how the melody, which was probably started with the mouth organ. The mouth organ, they started in with drums, and then they used bells and mouth organs to set the pitch. And then they probably played the melody with lutes and singing. But how that acted as a counterpoint to the bass rhythms of the bells and the drums, and even the stone chimes in the background, we don't really know how they all interacted, whether the dancers had danced with flutes and waist drums. It's quite possible. Some descriptions of performances say this. And we don't know when the stone chimes were played. They were obviously extremely important because in descriptions of ancient music, when you have the jiu cheng, nine cheng movements, it means that you have completed your piece of chime music using bells and stones. So jiu cheng is nine movements, means you've done your complete piece. So the other thing we don't know is, besides the magical number of nine, which we'll look at a little bit, is whether each time they move into a new one, did they change the pitch? Did they change the musical mode? We don't know. We can't really reconstruct that yet. Okay, so now we'll get a little bit into the magic of number nine. It turns out in ancient texts of this time period that jiu lu, nine pitches, was also called jiu bian, which means nine alterations, which those of us who have been studying the commentaries to the Zhou'i can feel very excited about, because basically it means to alter, to change from yang to yin. Yang is sort of the positive, rising energy, and yin is the retreating energy. And one of the aspects of musical performance in ancient China was, and this is said in another bamboo text quite plainly, but also in some of the prefaces to the Book of Odes, is that the purpose of these odes, the purpose of the music, is to transform base instincts into refined senses. So you really are using the music to transform your more base sense of personal, you know, human instincts into a much more refined self. And that's going to be key. So basically nine lu, or nine bian, or nine cheng, was nine of something being completed. So it was nine completions. And this text, which is from the Zhou Li, by the way, also shows you the use of the bells and the nine bian. And the nine bian are associated with the performance of the nine shao dance, a nine-part shao dance, which of course is associated with a prehistorical king, a mythical age where ministers were more loyal and did not try to usurp power from the real kings. And this nine shao shong, song, basically celebrated nine de. So each movement you can think of as developing a kind of de. Now what is de? Okay, besides sounding like stupidity, duh. No, it's de is a kind of spiritual energy that originally it changed, the actual meaning changed throughout time. And we're going to be looking at this. We're going to actually be dealing with both definitions. The earlier time period, it meant a kind of energy that had to be handed down through ancestral spirits. And it came from heaven, and it came with the mandate of heaven to the first Zhou king, who was moral, the moral king. And then as all the ministers who worked for the Zhou king could get de from working for the Zhou king, that's how they got their achievement. And then they could pass it on to their heirs through a certain ritual. And we'll be looking at that a little bit more later. So this de was a kind of spiritual power. Now later on, by the 4th century BC, it was competing with a different kind of spiritual power, qi, which was an all-pervasive sort of atomic, almost, energy that was inherent in all objects, anything manifest that we can see, all reality. And de was just the positive or the yang version of that qi. So de changes over time. And this piece that we're going to be looking at is sort of caught a little bit in between. Now, the other thing about this Jolie comment is that after you've completed the nine shao, the nine bian, and the nine de, then the spirits have descended and they're part of your performance. And other songs in the Book of Odes, for example, have depictions of the spirits getting drunk and dancing wildly with the other people. So we don't really know what these spirits are up to, but once they're happy, that's good. So a little bit on nine de and nine shao. So by the 4th century BC, the Confucians have really redefined de. Instead of just a spiritual power that one could grasp from one's ancestors, you had to build it up internally, and it had to do with moral acts, according to the Confucian idea of a moral act, which basically meant to obey your ancestors or obey the model of the historical kings. And we'll be seeing a little bit more of this. They also, one of the key aspects of this was that by the 4th century BC, we have to understand that the worship of ancestral Zhou kings was starting to be replaced by the prehistorical sage kings and the sort of mythical idea of the golden past and the ideal state and the ideal ruler and the ideal minister. So the real lineage of De was being replaced by sort of an idealized one. And in fact, the dance of Shao was associated with one of these mythical kings who was an ideal minister. Most sinologists know this, but there were many, many magical nine things. There were nine songs of ancient Chu that was associated with shamanism, nine palaces, which is associated with meditation in the sky. There's nine cauldrons, which presumably Zhou Gong had helped settle into the Zhou state, but in fact, this is a myth of Warring States time. There are nine nines, which is the basis of the Suan Biao of the earliest calculator, which was found with the Shurfa. It's also a Qinghua text. And it's also the basis of later mathematical texts as well. There are nine continents or nine provinces, and this is very important, and this is associated again with a mythical god king sage who was a good minister and didn't try to usurp power. And of course there's the nine completions, which are the most important part of our talk today, which has to do with not only the completion of a musical performance, but it symbolized the completion of a person when a person achieved their capping ritual and could become a complete person, a chengren, an adult. Now, there's a early medical aspect to nines as well. For example, from the Huangdi Neijing, this graph, by the way, is an old form of the word qi. And as you can see, it has to do with fire rather than vapor or water, whereas de had to do with the heart. The other part is just a phonetic. And so one of the aspects, nine also associates the microcosmos of the body with the macrocosmos of in terms of numerological power. So the openings of the body, the qiao, which could allow the passage of qi, is what you could use to get in touch with heaven. And these were counted as nine. You had nine openings, theoretically nine openings in your body, and these could also connect to nine different types of organs within your body. There was five of one type, four of another, which makes nine. And that's how you could connect through meditation or through all sorts of other visualization methods or through medical ideas of yang and yin qi with heaven. Heaven, by the way, is where time was divided, and of course it was divided up by sixes. Now, of course, nines and sixes both share the factor of three, and three is, oddly enough, according to the Huangdi Neijing, this same passage, three was the divisions, the perfect divisions of qi, this pneumatic energy. And each different kinds of qi had three of those. So there was three types of yang qi, there was three types of yin qi, and there were three types of mixed up qi. And of course, that's exactly our trigrams, which is three lines of different types of qi, and which were put together in heavenly combinations of six lines, which made up the hexagrams of the I Ching tradition. So we can see that the magic of nines is intimately caught up with divination. And the only problem with this really neat picture is that we're not too sure how complete it was in the 4th century BC. The Huangdi Neijing is a slightly later text. And by Han times, this sort of cosmological picture was much more complete, and we can document it much better. We are not too sure for the earlier time period. Okay, so one of the interesting things is in a text that's from about the same time period, maybe a little later than the lute dance, there are actually the 12 pitches are used in a form of divination. Not too sure how it works. But they seem to be correlated with, you know, spaces of time, times of the day, the directions, and the five different kinds of processes or agents, which is, what is it, wood, fire, metal, water, and earth. And so all of these probably were considered, but how and in what way, we're not too sure. The text is a little bit cryptic. All we have to do is really understand that the number nine represented a kind of transformation. To achieve nine, it had a transformative value. And one of the aspects of it that is most important in early ideas or cosmology is that by completing the yang, the 9, which was a yang number, you then, in the I Ching tradition, could flip from yang into yin. So we'll keep this in mind as we work through our text and start completing our yang 9. The other thing that we have to keep in mind is what was the role of the pitches, the musical pitches, the music behind the scenes of the text and the transcribed songs. We know it was there. We don't exactly know how it works. So there is a chapter, this book of documents has sections on prehistorical sages, and it has sections on the Zhou, especially, and tons of chapters having to do with Zhou Gong. But at the end of one of the chapters on prehistoric sages, it has this cute little musical performance documentation. And the important player in this is music master Kui. So he was almost as famous as any of the god kings. Music masters were could work with divination, they could had magical powers, etc., etc. So we see here in this documentation about music master Kui, we see that with the crescendo of musical chimestones and bells, together with drums, string instruments, and singing, these guests would take their seats, and of course they had to defer to the one who had the most de. The guests were lined up according to how they were perceived in terms of the de ranking, so it was a hierarchical system. And the performance then continues. It brings in the mouth organs, which probably set the pitch for the singing, and the large bells, which probably helped remind people of the rhythm. And at this point, suddenly we have such intense cosmic harmony that all the wild animals start to dance. They go into line and everything starts becoming in order. And now we also see that these wild animals, they're talking about these wild animals. Now commentators have a lot of debate about this. Did it really do this to the wild animals? Or were these just dancers dressed up to look like wild animals? It could go both ways, right? Nobody knows, but there are other texts of the time period that suggest that proper moral behavior by a king or a person in power, and also music, had a magical harmonizing effect on the surrounding min, the people, as well as the natural environment. So it had an effect that went beyond just one person. Now, one thing we see here at the very end of it is that after the 9 completions or the 9 movements are done, we have the phoenixes, mythical birds, which probably represented the spirits. They arrive. And, of course, at the very end, the most important fact is our young lords are harmonized and in touch with what's going on. Now, a little bit about music. I don't want to go overboard with numerology, but I would like to pique your curiosity a little bit. So the oldest full orchestra that we have discovered in a tomb is from 433 BCE. And we already know that the bells there, I showed you the bells at the very beginning, the sets of bells conform to the idea of 12 pitches. So we already know that this was an active concept, and that each pitch was approximately 3 half tones from each other. So again, we're dealing with factors of 3. We don't want to get into this too much. There were 64 bells of graduated size, 32 stone chimes of graduated size. These stone chimes, by the way, are big. They're up, they're human size. Here they look like little things that you put on your desk. No, they're huge. And 3 different kinds of lap lutes or zithers of various numbers of strings, and a host of other instruments, including flutes, mouth organs, and drums. So the bells, here we have them again. This tomb had a huge central chamber, and the bells took up a whole wall of two whole walls of the chamber, and the rest of the chamber had hundreds of feasting vessels, bronze vessels of all different kinds, ready with different kinds of foods and delicacies to treat the guests who were there with their little lacquer tables. We also had the musicians and the lutes and that sort of thing, but unfortunately these tombs are waterlogged, so things tended to drift. So we don't know precisely their orientation within the tomb. Now, one thing is that the bells themselves were designed purposely to have two pitches on a single bell. And each of these pitches are perfect majors or minor thirds apart. So it was important. Okay. Here's a few artifacts that give us a sense of the musical performance. We see here up and above some performers with their lutes their lap lutes on the bottom and their mouth organs as well. Probably they were both involved in the singing or the aspect of the song which we'll be looking at. Now, according to transmitted texts, these musicians were blind, but we don't really know. And in the other part, the lower part of this picture, we see it's from a pictorial bronze from around this time period, maybe a little earlier, and we see an ancestral shrine. We see the dancers. We see the different musical chime, the chime bells, the chime stones, the mouth organs, drums, and some of the ritual offerings being offered. And here's the dancers over here. Now, for the lute dance itself, I would like you to consider there are a number of performers that we can definitely identify. One is Zhou Gong, and I'm going to say that he's the music master. And I'm also going to say that as music master, he's the instructor, which fits with his legend of who he is. And then the next person we have is King Cheng. And he's the heir. He's the person who has to be instructed. So Zhou Gong is both warning the heir, but also they're warning the so-called many officers, the group. Now, the group are symbolically, in terms of the historical paradigm, the officers of Shang who have to be settled in the new city. But they're also, in terms of Western Zhou performance ritual, they're a peer group of elite young men who were probably cousins or brothers of the heir. And so we're going to have in this lute dance, the music master at the very beginning, we're going to have King Cheng and we're going to have the group. And really what we're doing is we're using the magic of the historical model to transform the present and also to use it as an educational training form. Oops. Yeah, okay, so people argue that this song, some scholars say, oh, it must be Zhou music. It's not Zhou music. It's late music. It belongs to the 4th century BCE. It's not Zhou. But we have to give credit to the Zhou tradition from which it does come. And so a few points that I haven't mentioned already is that the heir in his training for a ritual to grasp the De from his ancestors was documented on many bronzes, particularly from the middle of Western Zhou, 9th century up through the 8th. And this performance involved receiving the De in their heart. It took place when the heir, or this person, this Xiaozi, this young person, this youth, was going to take up officially the seat of his ancestor that had been vacated probably through death, most likely through death. And this De, during the Western Zhou period, as I mentioned, came down through heaven and came down through the lineage. And it was also came down through a process of Ming, through a process of command, many of which also included warnings. The other aspect of this is it involved modeling yourself, to train yourself to perform this in the proper way, awesome decorum manner, which meant that you were totally refined. You had to model yourself on your ancestral's pattern, and this pattern modeled itself on the founder kings of Zhou. Now, this word model, Xing, also was the word used to shape a bronze vessel. So the bronze vessel, which talked about the modeling process, it had sort of a nice sort of layering metaphorical aspect to it in terms of creating yourself in the model of the past. Oh, I did want to mention too, briefly, I know you're getting sick of these. This reconstruction here for De happens to be exact homophone for the word for God, Di. So you could almost think of De as being a kind of deism. So maybe we should translate de in old times as a kind of divinity. Okay, so 4th century BC. Suddenly things change. We no longer have a single unifying state. The Zhou is gone. They've disintegrated after the 8th century BC. That we have all these little fights, all these little states who are fighting for survival. So instead of having a real state that you want to train yourself for, you have an idealized state. You use mythical kings, including the Zhou kings, but also prehistorical kings. And this becomes the Tao of the former kings, the way of the former kings. So you follow one Tao or another as your personal pattern for self-cultivation. And this, in this self-cultivation method, you have to contemplate. Now this word si is going to be important because it appears repeatedly in the lute dance. And it's through this, through your own heart, in which has the incipient ability to cultivate de, which comes from tian, which now has this larger cosmic sort of nature, big nature with a big N sense, although not quite. It sort of vacillates between being the place of shangdi, of the high god, and also being total nature. It's through harmonizing yourself with this that you're able to nurture your de. Okay, and also one of the aspects of displaying this de is being able to dance with a wei yi quality and then carry this quality of wei yi into other aspects of your life. And one of the points of this is to train yourself to be able to properly perform in a government position, just like Zhou Gong. Okay, now we're getting into the meat of my talk. And don't worry, it goes faster. So now we're going to look at the talk movement by movement and sort of look at the buildup of De. Basically, the song trains the group. It's training the group through the warning narrative mode to worship the spirits, to model themselves on the ancients. And they don't really say who the ancients are, but they model themselves on the ancients. And they do this through a process of si, through the contemplation in your heart. And that involves envisioning the spirits and presenting offerings. So they're going through the old ritual patterns of ancestral offerings, but they're doing a new kind of self-cultivation method through the techniques of the heart. And what we want to think too is how the rhythms of the text or the counterpoint of the text that we're looking at actually try to imagine music in the background with all those instruments that I showed you, that there is a counterpoint going on here between the text and music. We just don't quite know what it is. But it's the combination of these two that the acolytes would dance to and model themselves somehow on their ancients. Okay, so now we're getting to King Cheng's song. One of the problems is we don't really know who's singing. When was it the heir in the role of King Cheng, or was it the group? You know, for example, is one person singing in the opening and then the group as a chorus, as some people say, in the closing? We really have no idea, and I'm just going to let you guys imagine that and think about it. What we do have to understand is that with each movement, some level of de was seemingly achieved. And in this particular stanza, we see that the spirits are getting closer. The group is warned to keep paying their respects to them and to imitate the patterns of the ancients in order to express their own de. In the second movement, we see the employment of the heart method hinted at through the multiple use of the word si to contemplate. It's in green. And here it functions both as a full verb to think and also just as a sound word, which I sometimes just translate as so, to sort of be like si. But it has this sense, it appeared in the Book of Odes too, it's a sound word, but it also has meaning. And here it just emphasizes how the ancients also used the heart technique. So if you're going to imitate the ancients, you have to use the heart technique. In the third movement, we find this funny question asking about the nature of Da. This is something a Western Zhou performer would never, never ask. And yet, by this time, because of the pervasiveness of the idea of qi, they had to sort of ask, what's this Da stuff, and how does it have to do with ancestral spirits? And so here it becomes also a lesson for the group, for the students. And one of the interesting aspects of it is this one sentence in the closing where it says, it is not heaven that gives rise to Da. So heaven is not just handing out Da. Heaven, it doesn't just naturally occur like leaves on a tree. You actually, and no one really makes Da, you have to kind of earn it. So Da is earned through the performance, through each movement. And it was still a power, but it had to be accumulated through good acts. Accomplished men, by the way, refer to the ancestors. Also, awesome decorum is wei yi. That's our expression of Da through refined dance moves. So in the fourth movement, we see that the spirits have been successfully invoked into the ceremony. And this has, of course, been done through the presentation of offerings, through the musical performance itself, and through the actions of the heart, because the heart, through memory and through inner vision, through visualization, brings the spirits into the ceremony. And the second part of it is where the acolytes, the group, promise to be good governors. They have to regulate awards and give out proper punishments according to strict hierarchy in society and to whom deserves what. So here you can see that they're training to be good ministers, just like Chokul. So in the fifth movement, they have started to successfully earn some Da. But instead of directly grasping it from an ancestor, it flows down from the sky, from Tian, from heaven. And this receipt of flowing Da qualifies the many men, the group, for positions in the ideal government of the ideal king. So already we see some measure of success in the fifth movement. Okay, sixth movement. Now this, here we see a little intertextuality with the Book of Odes. The clear temple, the clear shrine, the Qingmiao was in the Book of Odes, was not only a place, a real place probably, but it was also a famous ode that was sung by a group, the Duoshi, the same group that is in the Book of Documents that's in this, that Zhou Gong created the song for, this song of warning. In honor of the founder of the Zhou ideal state, King Wen, and it is in honor, it's celebrating his Da, his accomplishments as a civil and administrator. And in this song, the performers actually grasp King Wen's Da, his Da. Now, in the closing verse here, you see that the lead student in the guise of the heir advises the group to gather around him, the leader, modeling themselves on his own behavior to continue to be awarded with De from the spirits in heaven. So in the seventh, the ancestors up in the sky are all next to the high god Di. They're all in their proper places, and they're at peace. Because they have full stomachs, they've had a lot of offerings by now, and they've been tranquilized with this and into a harmonic state from the music and the performance. But the group of men, they can't stop now. They can't stop their performance. They're warned. They have to keep up their efforts and continue persisting, no matter how tired they might be, into the next two movements. So again, the group are warned to follow the king and to keep their hearts from wavering. They have to keep order in their ranks in order to have the proper wei expression of de, and also in order to grasp the de, which is something that has to happen inside of the heart. And this is, of course, the essential step towards preserving the ideal state. Your state will not fail if you're able to do this. That's what fine de is all about. Oops. Ah, here we go. All right, so we've reached the final movement, and of course, I'm close to the end of my talk, too. Having once achieved a state of de, the young men are warned not to waste it. The exquisite, refined state of wei yi, a cultivated dignity, must be maintained. Not only you've worked to get it, but you must maintain it in all future dealings. It's something that you have to bring into your government service. Not only for success for yourself, but also for the state. And so the last warning for these young men is to remember always that the source of their own success is in their elders, their history, and their past, in the ancients. Now, one thing we want to think about is we've reached the ninth stage of de. We're at number nine. And so we're at the ultimate state of yang, which means the students could theoretically, if they didn't keep this up somehow or transcend the cycle of yang and yin, they're going to flip back into yin and have to do this over and over again until they transcend it and become a sage or an immortal and become part of that eternal time and permanent sagehood, perhaps. Okay, so that's it. Thank you for your patience.